So this summer, the world once again enjoyed the single greatest shared experience that is possible on our planet today. Now, some of you are looking at me with blank stares like you don't know what I'm talking about, and that's not that surprising because we live in the one country in the world that is mostly disinterested in the global phenomenon that is the World Cup. If you are unsure about what this thing is, it is an international tournament. 32 teams go through extensive qualifying to be able to make this 32-team field, and it's a tournament to crown a true world champion, the best soccer team in the world. And I know that some of you are rolling your eyes right now because you're looking at me and you know that I'm a soccer fan and you're like, you're sick of hearing about it. But just bear with me. I will admit that I'm biased. I love soccer. I love all things World Cup. This whole summer was glorious. I watched so much soccer all summer and it was fantastic. But you cannot lie with these numbers. When I claim that this is the world's greatest shared experience, I'm not just making that up. That's just not my bias. The numbers bear this out. So I couldn't find up-to-date numbers. They haven't released the numbers for how many people watched this year's. But I did find from the 2014 World Cup, 4 years ago in Brazil, over 3 billion people. Over 3 billion people tuned in during the month to watch some portion. And the final, 1 billion people watched. And this is just numbers on TV. When you compare that to the Super Bowl, 160 million people, to put that into perspective, just how massive this is worldwide. And that's just the people who are tuning in to watch at home on television. So that doesn't even take into account all of the people who got together and watched this in bars or city parks or stadiums around the world. In fact, that's one of my favorite things about watching the World Cup is as you're watching the game and a country scores, they'll do a cutaway to this massive park and you see these people celebrating. And since I know a lot of you didn't see that, I thought I would share some of those celebrations. Here's 90 seconds of what that looks like. I love these scenes because, you know, technology has extended our capabilities to be able to see events and things that happen on the other side of the planet. And we can watch on television and we can experience the game. We can see slow motion, frame by frame replay. And that's great, but there's no way to share. There's no way to reproduce that shared experience. There's no way that we can tangibly sit at home and experience what it's like to be in a bar or to be in a crowd like that and to have this shared experience with other people, this elation when suddenly this you know, our team scores a goal. There's nothing like that feeling of connection. There's something deep, deep within us that yearns for these kinds of moments. It's biological. We want to connect with other people. It's why that you see in these videos, people who are different races or ethnicities, you know, different religions, different socioeconomic levels, they all come together and they have this shared experience and their team scores a goal and they're jumping up and down and they're high-fiving. They're hugging each other. I mean, they are total strangers, a lot of them, and they are so connected in this shared moment. We were made for moments like these, moments of connection with other people. Now, if you're new to New Denver or you're visiting with us, we started this series last week, and we've been talking about one of our core values, the value of presence. What does it mean to be present, to be fully present in the places where we spend our time, where we spend our weeks, and to the people whom we encounter there? What does it look like to be present? And if you missed last week, I would encourage you to go back and take a listen, because we did some deep work to think theologically about how important this is and how core this is to our faith. What we found is that at the heart of our faith is a communication event where God, the fullness of who God is, became a human being, and the medium and the message of God's love and redemption came together in the person of Jesus. And that primary medium and method, Jesus, invested his life into other people who then invested their lives into other people. And that's how we're sitting here today. For 2,000 years, the love of God has passed person to person by people who are present to one another in their everyday kinds of lives. Today, I want to start digging into, as we continue this exploration of what does it look like for us to be fully present in the places where God takes us and to the people whom we encounter there, I want to dig into what is happening in this video. What's underneath that? What is that need and that drive and that desire? What is it that we long for and that we experience so much elation around? I mean, when you watch these people, they're experiencing, they're not thinking this through. It's just a moment of deep gladness. They're experiencing something that I think is transcendent. It's beautiful. And it's just that they needed a moment to break down the walls, to break down the restraints that hold us back from the thing that we long for so much. Of course, this isn't just a soccer phenomenon. This is not just a soccer thing. If you're a sports fan, it doesn't matter. You know that in arenas and in auditoriums all around the world, people gather together, and in these kinds of moments, their team scores a goal, and they're suddenly laughing together. They're crying when their team loses. They feel this deep sense of connection to one another. If you don't like sports, that's okay. You know what it's like to go to a place like Red Rocks and listen to a music concert and stand with the people next to you and put your arms around them and sway and sing at the top of your lungs the songs you know by heart. And there's something in us that just feels alive when we're doing something like that. We love moments like these, and we long for them because they are so fleeting in our everyday lives. It's why we keep paying more and more money to go to live events. Not just because we enjoy the entertainment, I think that that's part of it, but I think it's one of the few transcendent human connecting experiences that we have. It's what draws people back time and time again. Deep down, I think these experiences give us a sense of belonging, that we're connected to other people in some sort of transcendent way that goes beyond our own ability to explain it. And we feel them more deeply because they are so absent in all of the rest of our life. Increasingly today, we as a culture and a society, we feel lonely and isolated from one another. Surveys keep telling us this. I quoted this survey last week. Cigna Health did a survey of 20,000 adults and found that over half of the people surveyed said that they felt lonely today. Meanwhile, anxiety and depression, suicide are all at historic highs in this country, reaching epidemic proportions. And why is it? Why is it that we're in this state where we're materially rich and yet we're struggling with things like anxiety and depression and feeling lonely and disconnected? Why is it that that's happening? I mean, that's a really complex question that would take a lot of time, and people are spending a lot of time trying to figure that out. Last week, I talked about, I think one of the factors is the increase of our technology. We talked about this last week, that our technology that was designed to help us to connect to things, to events, to entertainment that are far away, even to connect to people who are distant from us, has actually begun reversing on itself so that we're so engaged in those things which are far away and those people who are far, far away that we're disconnected from ourselves, from our own thoughts and our feelings, and disconnected from the people who we're actually present, embodied with in those moments. And I think that's a part of the problem, but I think that fire has been burning for a while. The fire of individualism and isolation has been burning for a while, and technology is kind of just like the gasoline. Okay, maybe like the liquid hydrogen dumped on the fire. And it's just propelling us further and faster away from one another. So individualism has been coming for a long time. So where did that come from? Well, it's been almost 20 years since I read a book called Bowling Alone that a sociologist named Robert Putnam wrote. And he was studying this phenomenon that he noticed that social organizations, the community organizations, institutions that had once made up the fabric of this country were slowly starting to decline. And he looked at how organizations like the Rotary Club or like, you know, civic organizations or organizations like the NAACP were in decline. Even churches were starting to see people disconnect. People were unhooking themselves from these institutions that had made up the fabric of our communities. And he began to figure out why this was happening. And what he talked about was you know, in World War II, there was this communitarian spirit that the whole country came together, and there's this sense that we were in this together, that it was for this greater cause. And in the aftermath of that, in the 40s and 50s, there was this strong communitarian and civic spirit. People were committing to things. They were ready to come back and rebuild to start a new life. And it created this high watermark for institutions, civic institutions, community institutions that were caring about the common good. I mean, this building, this church building, was built in the late 40s, actually 1950. The church was organized in 1946. That was the high point for a lot of churches. If you drive around Denver, a lot of churches that were built during that time. And it's because this spirit, the culture of that time, flowing out of the World War II era, was beginning to connect and to commit to one another. But by the 1960s, that began to erode. Why? Well, because there were a lot of things that eroded trust in institutions, trust in one another. Vietnam, Watergate, Kennedy assassinations, the assassination of MLK, lots of things happened that began to cause people to distrust one another and to distrust institutions, government institutions, the church. People began to move towards more autonomy and less communitarianism. People were much more concerned about their individual livelihood and their individual happiness. The rallying cry of the 60s, tune in, turn on, and drop out. Timothy Leary, by the way, was famous for saying that, but he gives credit to Marshall McLuhan for coining that phrase. If you were here last week, you get it. If you don't, go back and listen to last week, and you'll know who Marshall McLuhan is. So we've just been heading more and more in this direction of isolationism and individualism for a very long time. And regardless of how much our biology and how much our wiring has this deep desire for connection with other people, we're also social creatures. Our default is to go with the crowd. We're going to do what other people around us are doing. So as the flow of culture moves us towards more individualism and more isolation, if we don't do anything actively to push against it, that's where we're going to go. And that's where we're being taken. That's where we are today. And we now live in this weird place where the only kind of communalism that there is this weird tribal communalism, which is like, who's in my tribe? Who's with me? Who's against me? And we're defining that in weird ways. Politically, we're defining it almost through our style, the entertainment choices that we like, the sports teams that we root for. There are these sort of lowest common denominator things that connect us to one another, and we define who's in and who's out, who's good and who's bad by these things. It's not a pretty picture where we are, the state of our relationships with one another in our country today. And I don't have to tell you that. You get up, you read the news, you look at your social media feed, you can see that the social fabric of our country has unraveled. It's come unraveled. But the question for us is, what do we do about it? I mean, is there anything that can be done about it? Are we just sort of in the flow of this culture and this is where it's going and maybe it will reverse itself? Maybe we'll come unraveled as a country altogether? You know, the doom and gloomers would have you believe that. What do we do in the midst of this kind of reality? And what, if anything, does our faith in Jesus have to say about the state of isolation and rampant individualism that is present in our country today? Actually, I think we have a lot to learn from Jesus and a lot to learn from how he dealt with the cultural struggles of his day that give us insight into how we can maybe make different choices for ourselves. Because you see, as different as cultures are, and as different as cultures are even today as you look across the world, when you look back in history, you see that there are common threads that human beings, human nature has remained fairly similar. There are common themes and threads that emerge as we look back and we look at history to help us to see what is the possible way forward. So we can look at Jesus's time and ask the question, what was it like and how did he act in the midst of that? And what can we learn from him? So when we look back at Jesus's time, when we look at the cultural and relational dynamics that he lived in, what we see is that Jesus lived in an extremely divisive time, extremely divisive. I mean, Jesus was Jewish. He was a Jew living in the Roman province of Palestine. So at this point, this was the former kingdom of Israel. So Israel hadn't been a nation state. It hadn't been a kingdom for nearly 600 years at this point. I mean, people had lived and died for generations under the rule and occupation of other nations. The Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Persians, the list just kept coming. And finally, now it was the Romans. So here, you know, Jesus is growing up as a good Jewish person who has a sense of his ethnic identity is Jewish. And it's rooted in this faith and this belief that there's a God, Yahweh, selected the Jewish people and created them to be a nation, to be a light to the world. But the world that he lived in was a world where those people were under the boot heel of the Roman Empire. And meanwhile, they were also surrounded by historic enemies, enemies they'd fought with for hundreds of years. Not that much has changed in the Middle East, incidentally. Israel's still surrounded by people that they don't get along with. The Samaritans, Syrians, I mean, the Palestinians, it's all been very similar through history. And what we see is when we look at Jesus's time, we see this time of incredible discord. And if you remember from your Western Civ class, either in high school or maybe in college, the Romans were not benevolent rulers. They weren't necessarily gracious to the people that they conquered. They imposed huge taxes, which paid for the Roman war machine, for one, so they could continue to expand. But also those amazing things, like when we travel to Italy and we see the Colosseum and the aqueducts and the roads and we marvel at their engineering, that got paid for on the backs of really poor people that they had conquered and they taxed really, really heavily. So there was this tension. They hated the Romans. The Jewish people hated the Romans because they were their occupiers. Meanwhile, they also had really, really high tensions and high difficulties with other non-Jewish people that they lived among because they felt like they were outsiders living in their land. And so as a result, there was a lot of isolationism and Jewish people sort of clumped together and didn't really have anything to do with the Romans or anyone who were non-Jewish people, Gentiles. And so they lived in these tight-knit communities and avoided interaction with other people who were not like them. This was the socio-political reality that Jesus was born into, that he grew up into, and it's the reality that he faced as he began his ministry. And we're going to take a look at a story today that I think gives us insight into how Jesus thought about that reality and the actions that he took in response to it. It's a story that comes from the book of Matthew, which is one of the accounts of Jesus' life. And it's really interesting because the story that was written by this man, Matthew, is actually about himself. He's writing a story about his very first encounter with Jesus and what took place. So we're going to be in the book of Matthew in chapter 9 today. If you have a Bible and you want to follow along with us, you can do that. We're also going to put these verses on the screen. And what we're going to read about here is Matthew describing the first time he meets and encounters Jesus and what happens after that, because there's a really interaction where we see how Jesus thought about this separation, this division, this isolationism that was taking place in his own time. So starting in verse 9 of chapter 9 of Matthew, we read this. It says, as Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, he told him. And Matthew got up and followed him. So when Jesus meets Matthew, he's sitting at a tax collector's booth working. Now, as much as the Jews hated the Romans, they hated tax collectors even more. Why? Now, this is not your hatred for the IRS. It's a different kind of thing. So tax collectors in this time were employed by the Roman Empire to collect these really, really heavy and burdensome taxes. And they were Jewish people who were working for the Romans, and they were given freedom and authority by the Romans to take extra on top of what the Romans collected. They got extra for themselves. So they were getting rich at the expense of their fellow people. They were the tools of oppression that the Romans used to keep those that they occupied economically depressed. So Jesus stopping to talk, to speak to a tax collector without having some sort of business, like without having to come and pay his taxes for no reason other than just to come and say something to him, would have been controversial. But for Jesus, a Jewish rabbi, to say, come, become one of my followers, become one of my closest associates, follow me, come learn my way, come become a disciple, a follower, a student of mine, that would have been totally unheard of. But it doesn't end here. It's just beginning. Matthew accepts the invitation and he follows Jesus. And he follows Jesus. He takes Jesus back to his house for a meal. Verse 10, it says, while Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. So Jesus is invited to Matthew's house and he dines with other tax collectors and sinners. We're not even told anything about who these people are. We're just use the shorthand sinners, which means non-Jewish people, non-law keepers, Gentiles of some sort. Could have been Romans, could have been Greeks, could have been Samaritans. They were just not Jewish. They were on the outside looking in. Tax collectors, which were worse than sinners, and sinners. So these were the outcasts. These were the people that nobody would have anything to do with. And by accepting this invitation and eating a meal with these people, Jesus is crossing over all kinds of social, political, and religious lines. He's breaking all the rules of common decor in his time. And people take notice, in particular, the Jewish religious leaders of those days. There was a group of people called the Pharisees who were sticklers for the law of Moses. They were sticklers for Torah. They were sticklers for following what does it mean to be a good Jew. And they quibbled over the smallest of things about what it meant to live out the law. They, of course, took notice. They always took notice of what Jesus was doing and when he was stepping across their religious lines. Verse 11, when the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? On hearing this, Jesus said, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. So the Pharisees come to Jesus' disciples. They don't even go to him directly. They kind of want to avoid him. But Jesus finds out about it and finds out about their question. Why is it that your teacher is eating with tax collectors and sinners? All of these people who are socially, politically, and religiously unacceptable. And Jesus says, well, let me just give you an instruction using the text that you hold so dearly. And Jesus reaches back and he pulls a verse from the prophet Hosea. And in this verse, God is saying through Hosea to the people of Israel at that time, that I desire mercy, not sacrifice. That is, showing love, compassion, and kindness to other people is more important than keeping religious rules. He's saying, go and learn what that means. And then you'll understand why I'm eating with who I'm eating with and why I'm crossing the lines that I'm crossing. Now, remember from last week, when we watch Jesus, we're seeing the full embodiment of God's message of love and compassion and redemption to the world. It's not just the things that he says, it's how he lives those things out. See, Jesus could have gone to a synagogue, he could have gone to the temple, and he could have preached a very elegant sermon about Hosea. He could have gone and talked about what it means to show mercy and to not desire sacrifice. What did God mean by that? He could have given an eloquent sermon. I'm sure he could have done an amazing job. But he doesn't go to the synagogues. And he doesn't go to the temple. He doesn't teach a lesson, at least not with words. Instead, Jesus goes to dinner. He takes simple everyday things, a table, some bread, some wine, and he turns them into tools to create connection for belonging, and welcoming people who are ostracized, isolated, and lonely. People who had been rejected by their own, people who were pushed to the edges of society. And Jesus says, at my table, everyone is welcome. No matter where you were born, no matter where you're from, whether you're rich, whether you're poor, man or woman, tall or short, powerful or insignificant, everyone is welcome. Jew, Gentile, Roman, I don't care. If you want to get to know me, come on, have a seat at the table. Let's share some bread, let's share some wine, and let's get to know one another. Let's hang out. Let's have dinner together. And I look at this scene and I'm struck by a couple of things. First of all, I'm struck by Jesus's courage. We just assume that Jesus just easily did the right thing. But remember, he's fully God and he's fully man. And in his divinity, there's nothing he could do but to show God's character for all and love for all people. That all people are welcome, regardless of their background, their history, where they're from, or what they look like, what they've done in their past, everyone is welcome. So there's a part of him that's just the natural thing he would do. But he was a good Jewish boy as well. I mean, he had been raised to keep kosher. He knew what keeping a kosher table was, and he had to push through all of those tensions. He knew how much people hated the Romans. He knew what this was going to cost him. He knew that this was going to set him at odds with pretty much everybody in his culture. And he had the courage to push past those cultural pressures in order to live out what it meant to show love and compassion and to be the message of God's love and redemption to the world. And I think about those people who were eating with him, Matthew and the rest, the people who didn't even get a designation, just they were just sinners. What must have been going through their heads? They've spent most of their lives being told they're not good enough. They're not welcome at the table. They're not welcome. They're sinners. People had only told them that because of what they had done, because of who they weren't good enough. Can you imagine the shame in the sense of isolation, how they must have felt ostracized at every turn in their life, to be welcomed by this Jewish teacher and to be able to feel that kind of connection and belonging that we all long for, we all want as human beings, how that must have felt for them. Jesus pushes through all of those things and says, you know what? That's not what God's like. Come on, let's sit down. Let's have a meal together. Let's eat. Where there was once shame and isolation, loneliness and despair, now there's acceptance. There's belonging. And there's love at that table. There's grace. This is the heart of God's message to the world through Jesus. That you and I are accepted just as we are, not as we should be, because no one is as they should be. Everyone is accepted and loved by God and welcomed at his table. Jesus passed this message on. He poured this message out. This wasn't the first time he ate this kind of meal. He became known as a person who hung out with sinners and tax collectors. They called him a drunkard. He was willing to come and share wine and sit at a table with people who were so very different and people who were not acceptable. And he passed this way of living on to his first followers, to his disciples. And when he left them, when he ascended to be with the Father and he sent the Spirit, he sent them out in the world to do the same. And for 2,000 years, Ben, that's been the way that this has happened. People gathering together, showing the love of God through simple things. How do we, to go back to the question that started this, how do we push against the pressures of our culture and our time of isolationism, individualism, autonomy, anxiety, depression? How do we push against all of those things? I think we use the same things Jesus did. A table, a little bread, a little wine. As a good Southern boy, I would say maybe some cornbread, some barbecue, some sweet tea. And come on, let's eat, y'all. I think it's just that easy. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to necessarily turn the culture upside down or change the flow of where things are going, but we can live counterculturally. We can choose to cross those lines in the same way that Jesus did. We can push against the flow of culture, because if we don't do that, we're just going to get carried right along with it. But who gets invited to our table? Who do we reach out to? Who are the people that we welcome to the table? Well, the guest list is up to you. But as we practice being present in the places that God takes us to, I promise you won't miss the people that are on the edges if you're paying attention, because they're there. They're there. If 50% of the world is feeling lonely, 50% of Americans are feeling lonely today, those people are already in your life. Maybe for you, it's the guy at work who always eats lunch at his desk by himself. Maybe it's an opportunity for you to go and say, hey, let's go to lunch, my treat. I'd love to get to know you a little bit better. Maybe for you guys as students, it's in the lunchroom, the weird kid or the weird kids that always end up sitting by themselves. Nobody wants to sit with them. Maybe it's you inviting them to come and sit with you, or you going and sitting with them. There is no more lonely or isolated place in the world than a middle or high school cafeteria. Maybe for you, it's the neighbors on your street that you don't know so well. Maybe it's time to invite them over. Wheel your barbecue grill to the front yard so that if anybody you missed is walking by, you can invite them to just come on in and join you. We've become a backyard society. We gather with people who live all around the city, and we create little private parties for all the people that live on our street. You're not welcome. We have friends already. What if we became front yard people who said, everyone's welcome at this table? What if we began to go and get to know the neighbors that live right next door to us? Loneliness, isolation, it's as close as next door. Maybe it's as simple as getting up and walking across these aisles to say hello to somebody you don't know. You don't think loneliness and isolation is in this room with us today? You think that somehow the church is immune to that? There are people struggling today because they feel lonely and they feel alone. And for some of them, coming to church is a lonely experience. So where do you start? That's up to you. We'll be glad to help you. We'll give you ideas. We'd be glad to talk with you. If you want to throw a neighborhood barbecue party, we'll even pay for it. We put out this thing called Mission Grants, where we want to help you take steps to create connection and community in your neighborhood. If you want to do something like that, but you feel like it's too expensive, let us know. We'll help you pay for it. We'll take that barrier out of the way. But I'm guessing for some of you, this sounds really exciting and a great challenge. But for others of you, this is super intimidating. And it's nerve-wracking to think about going to that person at work that you don't know so well. It's nerve-wracking to think about going to a neighbor's door and knocking a person that you don't know and maybe inviting them to come have dinner with you. I think it takes courage to take these steps towards breaking down the walls that separate us. And I think that courage comes from rooting ourselves in the reality that we are first and foremost already loved and accepted ourselves. If we don't have the belief that we are already good enough, we are already accepted, we are already loved by God, because we have chosen to follow Jesus and to receive God's love and his redemption, if we don't have that, you can't just gut it out and be strong enough or be courageous enough. This is the love of God that flows through us and into the world. In just a few minutes, the band is going to come and we're going to celebrate communion. We're going to come to a table and we're going to take some simple things, some bread and some wine, and we're going to remember. Maybe for some of you, this will be the first time you come to that table and accept you are good enough. In God's eyes, it doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter how bad you think you are. God loves and accepts you just as you are, not as you should be. Because none of us are as we should be. And rooted in that that identity as God's loved and chosen people. The service is going to end, and we're going to get up and we're going to go out into our world, our workplaces, our neighborhoods, and we're going to encounter broken, lonely, isolated, individualistic, technology-ridden people. And the question is, will we have the courage to push against the flow of culture and begin to invite those people to a holy table of acceptance and love, sitting around over coffee, over lunch, over dinner? Your assignment this week is to continue practicing presence. Use your breath prayer now, here, this, to draw yourself to what is here, what is now, what is happening around you. And as you do, look for the people that God has brought into your life and ask yourself, who are the people that I could reach out to go to lunch, to go to coffee, to come to dinner? Let's be people that create holy spaces of acceptance, love, and belonging in a world that desperately needs it. What kind of difference might that make in your life, in my life, if we just committed to do that once? If all of us in this room did that once this week, that would make a huge difference, at least in the people's lives that we share our life with. So let's pray as we close that God would give us both the clarity to see those people and the courage to actually follow through. Let's pray. Father, we begin just by thanking you that we're loved and accepted, that we belong to you. We are yours. Not because of what we've done or not done, not because we've done things right or we're born in the right place or because we come to church or any of those things. You love us because that's who you are. You're our Father. You created us and you love us and you accept us. And you call us into life. You call us to follow the way of Jesus, to be people who root ourselves in that identity of love and acceptance, and then go out into a world to pass that on, to give that to other people. May we have the clarity to see the isolated, ostracized, hurting people in the world around us. And may we have the courage to reach out to them in love and acceptance, to create holy tables, places that people can feel your love, your acceptance, your grace through us. Pray these things through the Son and by the Spirit. Amen.